welcome to Creating a Family, Talk About Infertility. Today, we're going to be talking about what to eat to increase your odds of success with IVF. We'll be talking with Dr. Jorge Chavarro. He is Associate Professor of Nutrition and Epidemiology at the Harvard School of Public Health and of Medicine at Harvard Medical School. Dr. Chavarro's research is focused on understanding how nutrition and lifestyle impact human reproduction. He is one of the principal investigators of the Nurses Health Study 3, which is an ongoing prospective cohort of young professional women starting in 2010, designed to investigate the role of lifestyle and biologic factors on women's health. And he leads the nutrition component of the Earth Study, an ongoing prospective cohort of couples undergoing infertility treatment at the Massachusetts General Hospital. Welcome, Dr. Chavarro, to Creating a Family. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you for having me today, Dawn.
This is a topic of personal great interest. I am fascinated by it, but it's also a topic of interest to both patients and nurses and other medical professionals. So we will just dive right in. How does nutrition impact fertility? We know that women are born with all the eggs that they're ever going to have. So how does nutrition impact female fertility and egg quality? It seems like the most important nutrition would be those of our mothers when we were being gestated. But so why is it important after the fact?
Well, you're correct that a woman's ovarian reserve is essentially determined in utero, and all the eggs that you're going to have, that has already happened. However, that doesn't mean that the quality of any individual egg is determined at birth already, or that whether or not women ovulate in any one particular cycle is also determined at birth. There are many other things that influence the regularity of menstrual cycles throughout a life and the regularity of ovulation, as well as the quality of individual eggs throughout a woman's life. And that's where nutrition plays a role. And nutrition is really a very broadly defined exposure. There's no one thing that nutrition is. And we have known how some aspects of nutrition impact fertility for a very long time, starting with body weight and exercise, which are kind of the opposing ends of energy balance. But over the last decade or so, we have also gained an enormous amount of understanding about how the quality of diet may also impact fertility. And let's not forget that reproduction is a team sport. So yes, women are the one who do get pregnant, but until we figure out a different way to do it, we still need men for reproduction. And men's and spermatogenesis is a much more active phenomenon.
How often do we will a man produce a completely new set of sperm?
About every 3 months. So about every 3 months, there's a completely new set of sperm that are being created. So it is a much, much more active process, much more, and therefore much more susceptible for intervention and much more susceptible to external environmental cues.
Okay, so if a woman is wanting to impact the quality of her eggs, as well as her general fertility, mm-hmm. How far in advance would she need to change her diet?
It depends. So it depends what we're talking about. And there's actually not a lot of clarity on that one particular point, on how soon do I need to be doing things. So the way I like to think about nutrition and reproduction is try to break it down into what are the big things that we have a lot of information about, and we're fairly confident on them, and more some of the things where we are just gathering information and there's less confidence on those. So on the things that we know a whole lot about, the first one is definitely the impact of body weight. We've known that for decades, and we have just gotten a much better and more refined understanding on how weight impacts fertility. So the earliest studies on weight and fertility date back to the 1970s. And we're looking at extremes, mostly very low body weights associated with extreme levels of exercise, and how they impacted ovulation and menstrual cycle regularity. And from that, we know that both being underweight, but also being overweight and obese, which was evidence that was gathered a few years later, are not that good in terms of ovulation. You want to be somewhere in the middle. Now, what does that mean in terms of if you happen to be on one of the extremes, like if you're either lean or overweight, how soon do you need to start changing weight, either gaining weight or losing weight, if you're trying to start a family? And those are effects that are relatively quick, right? So within a few months, you can start seeing regulation of ovulation and resumption of normal menses in case that menses had been interrupted. And in many cases, resumption of fertility. And where that has been documented the best is among women with polycystic ovary syndrome, where we know that weight loss actually improves, leads to resumption of menses and improves fertility. Where that does not seem to be the case, however, is among women who are undergoing assisted reproduction. So there have been, for the longest time, based on the studies among women who are trying to get pregnant on their own, the assumption had been that women who are undergoing fertility treatment who are overweight or obese would also benefit from losing weight immediately before treatment. However, in the past 3 or 4 years, there have been 2 randomized trials testing this specific hypothesis, asking women who are overweight to lose weight immediately before starting fertility treatment. And what both trials found is that even though there's an improvement in spontaneous pregnancies, meaning women who were having fertility problems and lose weight and are trying on their own, were scheduled for assisted reproduction and start trying on their own, some of them do get pregnant. But women who actually make it to fertility treatment do not benefit from losing weight immediately after infertility treatment.
Why? Do we have a theory as to why?
So I think that infertility treatment with assisted reproduction is such an intense intervention that the benefit of weight loss is probably weakened given the how intense the intervention is. That's one possibility. The other possibility is that if you think about it, losing weight is closer to going into starvation mode, right? Than other things in terms of the reproductive axis. So yes, you do get some metabolic improvements, right? So your blood glucose and your lipids are going to get better, but the message your brain is getting in terms of reproduction is there is a shortage of food. Mm-hmm. It's probably not the best time to try to get pregnant, and therefore it is possible that if you need to lose weight for assisted reproduction, you probably need to do this way ahead of time. It's not just 2 or 3 months before, as these trials have done, but it is possible that if weight loss is effective for some women, it is a weight loss that happens years before starting treatment when people are not even thinking that they're going to be needing treatment. So it becomes kind of a catch-22, and for practical implications, there doesn't seem to be much benefit in terms of the ability to get pregnant. There is a benefit in terms of, for those who do get pregnant, they do get better pregnancy outcomes, however.
Yeah, that would make sense. And has there been any new research or any research on how someone loses weight? From what I'm hearing you say, if for natural conception without fertility treatment, weight loss is effective, but for fertility treatment not, does it matter how you lose the weight, gastric bypass versus diet?
No. So the two trials that have addressed this question in women who are undergoing fertility treatment, they tried 2 very different approaches. One was more of a standard calorie reduction with making all your portions smaller, but eating a lot less. The other one was a much more intense intervention in terms of calorie restriction, and was women who participated in the active arm were given liquid diets for around 700 calories per day. So it's a very, very severe calorie restriction. And in neither trial, this was effective. There have been some studies looking at, not trials, but a handful of case reports looking at what happens to women who lose weight through bariatric surgery and then go on to fertility treatment, and the literature is very mixed on whether or not that is a good idea. But so there's not a clear consensus on whether how you lose weight matters. There have been some studies among women with PCOS looking at where not different diets make a difference, right? So if you have like a standard diet with fewer calories versus if you have like a low protein or low carbohydrate diet or things like this, does it make a difference? And the answer is no. Then the most important thing is to lose weight in the PCOS context, not so much how you lose it.
Okay. And we'll be talking further later on about specifics on food and diet. There's a lot of interest now in the human microbiome and how it affects really all parts of our lives, including our fertility. And we know, in fact, we have a course on this about how the microbiome in the reproductive tract impacts fertility. So we know that the microbiome, we know that our reproductive tracts are full of microorganisms. So do we know anything about what type of diet is effective at maintaining a healthy balance within the microbiomes in our reproductive tract? I mean, they're different from, they're not necessarily connected to our intestinal tract, which of course is also full of microbiotics.
Yeah, that's actually a fascinating question. So, and everybody seems to be interested in understanding the microbiome these days, whether it is the gut microbiome or microbiome-specific organs. And so we actually just started a study looking at this, looking at whether or not what might impact the reproductive tract microbiome and to what extent that might explain differences across in success rates in women who are undergoing infertility treatment. So there is some emerging evidence suggesting that the vaginal and the microbiome and the microbiome recovered from transfer catheters from women undergoing assisted reproduction may be different between women who succeed and women who do not succeed in based on assisted reproduction. And there's also some evidence suggesting that the microbiome may also differ among women who are experiencing problems with fertility according to their primary infertility diagnosis. What's not clear is to what extent lifestyle or environmental factors might be able to impact that microbiome and whether or not you could intervene and change either directly or indirectly the microbiome. So I think this is an area where we're just starting to dip our toes into, but we'll be learning a lot more in the next 5 to 10 years, I would say.
Yeah, I bet we will. It's a really hot area for research right now. Let me pause and remind everyone that this show is brought to you by our corporate underwriter, Ferring Pharmaceutical. Ferring wants you to know about a new tool available for men. It's actually not that new. It's been out for a year or two now. It's the FertiStrong app. FertiStrong is a self-help fertility support app for your phone, and it's specifically designed for men, although I'll have to admit that most men find out about it from the women in their lives. So I'm talking to you women out there. Let your men know about this. The app provides techniques to empower men with knowledge and self-help skills throughout the stressful journey of infertility. And it helps the men cope with their own stress, but it also gives them techniques to help cope with the women in their lives, the stress of the women in their lives. To learn more about FertiStrong for yourself or for the man in your life, you can go to FertiStrong.com, FertiStrong.com. Now I want to talk about what research is showing about specific foods or diets that are best for enhancing fertility. And I mean both natural fertility as well as the fertility of those going through fertility treatment. And then we'll circle back to talking about what the research is showing about what we should actively be avoiding. So I know that you have done a tremendous amount of research in this area. So generally speaking, what are we supposed to be eating, or what are we supposed to be eating and consuming? What type of diet should we be following if we want to give ourselves the highest chances either at a natural conception or through fertility treatment?
Sure. So I generally like to focus on the things that have been consistent across studies and across outcomes. So there's things that seem to be equally good both for couples who are trying on their own, that on the male end appear to improve semen quality, and that also appear to be beneficial in couples undergoing infertility treatments. So one of the things that has been most consistent throughout is how omega-3 fatty acids, in particular, omega-3 fatty as it's of marine origin. So the ones that you would get from fish, the ones that are the longer fatty acids, which are EPA and DHA, how they appear to be beneficial across the spectrum. So there's quite a lot of literature on the male end showing both that consumption of fish seems to be related to better semen quality, that randomized trials where men are supplemented with fish oil also and show that men supplemented with fish oil end up having better semen quality, and that it doesn't necessarily have to be fish oil. So another source for those who do not like fish, another source of omega-3 fatty acids that's quite important are nuts. So there have been several randomized trials with nuts in the past few years showing that you see very similar effects when men are supplemented with nuts on sperm parameters. So in addition to that, we have seen that among couples who are undergoing fertility treatment, women who have higher blood levels of omega-3 fatty acids, which is a marker of essentially of their intake, do have better outcomes, are more likely to have live birth than women with lower levels. And this is, for the most part, reflecting their intake of fish in this part of the country.
So do we know that the higher levels of omega-3 fatty acid in the blood is coming from marine sources?
So when you find long-chain omega-3 fatty acids in your blood, there's only two ways that they could have gotten there. One is you ate them, right? And that's the most straightforward way. And the only way in which you could have eaten them is if you ate fish. There's no other way, there's no other natural source for you to eat them, either fish or krill or some other marine source of omega-3 fatty acids. You could also convert them from shorter chain omega-3 fatty acids, so from plant sources of omega-3 fatty acids, which include nuts, which some oils, and flaxseed and things like these. But the conversion of shorter chain omega-3 fatty acids to longer chain omega-3 fatty acids is fairly inefficient in humans. So for the most part, if you see omega-3 fatty acids, long-chain omega-3 fatty acids in someone's blood or adipose tissue or wherever, it's because they ate them. So that's why they can be, for the most part, interpreted as a marker of intake.
Okay, fascinating. Okay, so apparently there's good research that would indicate that increased consumption of fish and nuts, perhaps, are good for both men and women.
Men and women, and we've seen that both in men and women, both men in the general population as well as men in couples from presenting to fertility treatment. We've seen the benefit on live births on women undergoing fertility treatment. And we have also seen something similar among couples trying on their own. So comparing when both partners consume fish at least twice per week, we see their chances of their time to pregnancy being much, much shorter than the time to pregnancy of couples where neither one of them is consuming fish. And it translates to about a 10% lower risk of having time to pregnancy greater than 12 months, which is the definition of infertility. So it seems to be quite a remarkable effect size in terms of both consistency and being able to impact a wide range of outcomes that are relevant for both men and women.
Just out of curiosity, has there been research on vegans to say whether they have a lower overall fertility rate?
Not that I'm aware of. So studying vegetarianism and veganism is actually very difficult. Because people, even though there are technical definitions of what a vegetarian is and what a vegan is, not everybody understands the same when they say they are vegetarian or vegan. And the clearest example of that is from my own personal experience. I come from, I was born and I raised in Colombia in South America, which is a very high meat-eating country. So we eat a lot of beef. So I probably ate a tenth of the beef that I used to eat when I was younger. but you eat beef every single day. So when people in Colombia say they're vegetarian, what they usually mean is that they don't eat beef, but that doesn't necessarily mean that they don't eat meat. So if somebody says vegetarian, they say, oh, don't worry, we have chicken and we have fish. You're fine because So across many different contexts, what it means to be vegetarian or vegan or lacto-vegetarian or ovo-vegetarian, not everybody understands the same way. So it's very difficult to study in large populations. That said, one thing that I'm very happy you asked me about vegans, because it gives me the opportunity to talk about something else that has been quite important in fertility, is, as all vegans know, one thing that they have to be aware of is vitamin B12 deficiency. Because most of us get our vitamin B12 by eating meat. But if you do not eat any meat or any animal products, you do not have any natural sources of vitamin B12 in your diet. And the problem with that is that vitamin B12 and other nutrients related to vitamin B12, including vitamin B6 and folic acid, are part of this metabolic pathway called the 1-carbon metabolism, which, among other things, is in charge of producing the building blocks of DNA and of producing and of methylating DNA, meaning putting the reading code on top of DNA. So it's extremely, extremely important for DNA production, which means that it's extremely, extremely important for gametogenesis and for cell division. So on the male end, if you need to be replacing your entire population of sperm approximately every 3 months, being able to have a steady supply of DNA is critically important. And on the couple end of things, once you have a fertilized egg, it's not going to be able to produce its own machinery to actively incorporate either folate or B6 or B12 into the cells until its own genome is activated. So whatever folate, B6, and B12 was in the egg, was absorbed through mothers in the egg, that's what that embryo is going to have to support all cell divisions during the first 3 to 5 days of embryonic life. So those nutrients are critically, critically important for both spermatogenesis on the male end and for supporting the embryo through the first few days of life, which is important in assisted reproduction, but it may also be what underlies some causes of infertility that get identified as unexplained infertility or recurrent pregnancy loss or things like this.
And so that is B12, which we know we can get through meat. Does all meat have the same amount? Is there some meat that is higher in the B12, B6, folic acid? Well, let's say B12.
B12. So, no, you don't have to be that picky about B12. And one thing that is quite fortunate is that you don't have to actually eat that much meat, or you don't have to eat that meat at all to do B12. Most prenatal supplements include B12. So some strict vegans will actually not use standard prenatal supplements because of that B12 came from an animal product. But there are ways around that. So there are ways to get B12 through supplements that are okay for vegans. And most prenatal supplements will include a combination of folic acid, B6, and B12. And what most prenatal multivitamins include are within the intake levels that would be required for sustaining both spermatogenesis on the male end and for sustaining the embryo through its first few days of life.
Okay, and let's talk protein in general.
Yep.
There was some research a long time ago that was indicating that higher percentage, when your diet has a higher percentage of protein, it enhanced. And I honestly don't remember now whether it was, women's fertility going, women's success rate going through IVF. Has that been substantiated? Do we know what percentage of protein? We'll talk about the type of protein here in a minute, but how much protein should you be aiming for when you are trying to get pregnant naturally or when you're going through fertility treatment?
So I know exactly what study you were talking about because this was an abstract that was presented at ASRM.
Yep.
And I was one of the moderators in that session. I remember it quite well. So
And I was in the audience.
Okay, perfect. Yeah, so I know exactly which one. And it was a very interesting study. So this came from a group that's very much hands-on on advising their patients on their diets. And I can't remember the exact amount, but they kind of fairly high intakes of protein to their patients. And what they presented at ASRM was quite interesting and intriguing, by the way. So we waited and waited to see that paper published, and that paper was never published as a peer-reviewed article. So we decided to take a look in our data. We published last year looking at different protein sources and protein amounts in relation to outcomes of infertility treatment. What we found was that as a whole, protein didn't matter that much. So, and when you look
at type or quantity?
Quantity.
Okay.
And when you start looking at the source, at major sources of protein, there were only a handful of things that stood out. So one was fish, which we've talked about, right? So if you were higher in your protein intake because you were eating a lot of fish, then it did matter, but it didn't seem to be an effect of protein, but it was the fish itself. The other source was something we had published before, was when we were getting a category that we called beans and legumes, right? So that seemed to make some difference. But interestingly, most of the association was because of intake of soy, which is something that gets a lot of comment on the blogosphere on how it might relate to fertility. Mm-hmm. And what we and others have found is actually that either soy, which we looked at soy foods, and others who have done randomized trials of soy supplements, what we find is that it's actually beneficial. It improves live births in women undergoing assisted reproduction, which is kind of the opposite of what you see in the lay literature. But other than fish and soy, and to a lesser extent, other legumes and nuts, there didn't seem to be much on protein making a big difference. There were some equivocal findings when we looked at red meat intake. So when it was modeled in one way, it looked like it was beneficial, but if you modeled intake a different way, it didn't. So we reported, I was like, there's definitely not a clear signal of either harm or benefit with red meat or with other types of foods. There didn't seem to be a clear signal with dairy as a source of protein, with chicken or other poultry as a source of protein. And the only clear signals were with fish and with soy.
And then you're not clear whether that's the protein itself or the type of protein, other factors in the soy or the fish.
Correct. But so with the fish, it may be the case that it has absolutely nothing to do with the protein itself, but rather with the omega-3 fatty acids that we had discussed before. And on a practical level, this doesn't really matter, right? If it's the protein and you're eating the fish, then you get benefit. If it's the omega-3 fatty acids and you're eating the fish, you're still getting benefit. So on a practical standpoint, it doesn't matter that much. Same thing with the soy, right? So what we have been able to study is soy food intake. And if it happens to be the soy protein itself, then fine, and you're getting the benefit from eating soy protein. The other groups that have studied soy have used soy supplements, specifically isoflavone supplements, so extracting the phytoestrogens out of soy and using that as a supplement. And those seem to be beneficial both for couples undergoing infertility treatment with ART or with IUI. So if it is the phytoestrogens itself that are beneficial, then you'll get the benefit whether it is as a food or whether it is or if it's a protein, you would still get the benefit as by eating as a food.
So what about carbs? You know, we hear it's the total talk of the town.
Yeah.
The, as you call it, the blogosphere. It's certainly, mm-hmm. The internet is full of talk about low carb or processed carbs or complex mm-hmm. carbs. What does the research show as far as the intake of carbs or perhaps the percentage of carbs in your diet? And does it matter whether it's simple carbohydrates or complex carbohydrates?
Great. So again, thanks for asking that one, because that's another area where there has been somewhat of a consistent literature, both for men, couples trying on their own, and couples undergoing infertility treatment. Let's start with couples trying on their own this time. So that was one of our earliest publications where we looked at carbohydrate quality and quantity in relation to infertility due to ovulation problems. What we found back then was that women with a higher glycemic load, meaning that they had either a very high carbohydrate intake or a modest carbohydrate intake, but most of these carbohydrates were coming from rapidly digestible carbohydrates. They had about twice the risk of having infertility due to ovulation problems than women with the lowest end of glycemic load intake. This has been recently reproduced in another cohort of pregnancy planners. Now, this time looking at time to pregnancy as opposed to specific causes of infertility. They also see that better quality carbohydrates, not necessarily the total amount of carbohydrates, but having better quality carbohydrates, meaning lower glycemic carbohydrates, more fiber, less rapidly digested sugar, also seems to be beneficial for fertility. And it has also been seen for men in studies looking at semen quality as an outcome. So we know that the main contributor to glycemic load are rapidly digested sugars, right? So added sugars. And one of the top contributors to added sugars are sugar-sweetened beverages. And there's now a growing body of research showing that sugar-sweetened beverages are related to lower semen quality. And it's in some studies, it shows lower count. In other studies, it shows lower motility, but definitely not good for semen quality. And there have been some studies looking at fertility in couples trying on their own that have found that both the male partner intake and the female partner intake of sugar-sweetened beverages is deleterious to fertility independently of each other. So at least sugar beverages are definitely not a good idea for fertility, whether it is on the male end or the female end. And when we've looked in couples undergoing infertility treatment, again, the same story appears, the same pattern. So even though the total amount of carbohydrates doesn't seem to be that make that much of a difference between the ranges of intake that we see in people in Boston, the quality of carbohydrate does seem to matter. So the more whole grains that are part of total carbohydrates, the better outcomes of infertility treatment.
Well, what about then if you, rather than sugar-sweetened sodas, or what about shifting to diet sodas where you're using, where they would use artificial sweeteners?
So that's a great question. So we've, there is not a lot of research on artificially sweetened beverages. So one of our first papers, we looked at these because we were interested in caffeine, actually. We were looking at different sources of caffeine. And we ended up looking also at sodas as one of these sources of caffeine. And in that study, what we see is that sugar sodas did appear to have a deleterious effect on fertility, but the association with sugar sodas was very similar to the association with diet sodas. But that hasn't been always the case in across studies. So I would say that there hasn't been as consistent literature with diet sodas as there has been with sugared sodas. And in principle, if the culprit is sugar itself, that should work. So however, one of the people with whom I collaborate often is in the group examining environmental chemicals and environmental contaminants. And one thing that sugared sodas and diet sodas share is packaging. And several of the shared packaging are known sources of environmental chemicals that are known to impact fertility. So you could always do water.
I was just going to say, at this point, you can't win for losing.
That can be the best replacement.
Well, okay, but let's talk about another drink then. And there's some, for me, it was fairly interesting research, and that is consumption of whole milk products. And if I remember correctly from the research, it didn't hold over. It's not just the dairy product itself, because it didn't hold over when we were looking at low fat or skim.
Yeah.
Has that held up in the research?
That has been one of the most inconsistent ones. Yeah. So that was one of the first things that we published. So again, it was this in our initial study looking at infertility due to an ovulation as the main outcome. And what we found back then was that women who had higher intake of high-fat dairy foods, and this was primarily whole milk, had a lower risk of infertility due to an ovulation, but the opposite was true for low-fat dairy. So, and low-fat dairy was primarily intake of skim milk, and they seemed to have the exact opposite relation. It was a real head-scratcher trying to...
It was a head-scratcher. That's a good way to put it.
It was a total head-scratcher. It was like, are we sure we coded this thing correctly? So it was months and months of going back, making sure we had made no mistakes before we actually had to put it in paper and say, yes, here's my name attached to this finding. But I mean, we just, no matter what we did, that was the finding. And we have kept on the story of dairy, and it's very, very inconsistent across outcomes. So we've revisited the dairy story looking at semen quality, and it's not consistent. So we've looked at it in three studies now, in three different populations, and our findings are different in each of the three populations. So it's not consistent at all in relation to semen quality. It has been looked in relation to time to pregnancy on couples trying to get pregnant. And again, it's not as, there doesn't seem to be as clear a relationship with time to pregnancy, and this distinction between low fat versus high fat dairy doesn't seem to hold out. We looked at it in relation to outcomes of infertility treatment, and we do see some benefit, but for low fat milk, not for skim milk. So it has been very, oh, and the last one we did was for ovarian reserve. We looked at intake of dairy in relation to ovarian reserve. And then it was dairy intake itself was related to lower, to poor ovarian reserve. And it didn't really matter what type of dairy were into. It was dairy as a whole. So I think that dairy has been a very, very inconsistent story throughout the literature. So
jury is still out. Is that what you're telling us?
I think the jury is still out, and at this pace, it's still going to be out for a while.
Yeah. You mentioned caffeine. Yeah. What do we know about caffeine consumption and fertility?
Well, you would expect that one should be pretty clear. So definitely caffeine has been one of the most studied nutritional factors in relation to fertility. The problem has been that until fairly recently, there has been a pervasive problem with study design on studies looking at caffeine and fertility. So the typical study has been going to the fertility clinic and then asking women about their diet. So did you drink coffee over the last year or something like that during a specified time frame? Yeah. And as you're well aware, people who are undergoing infertility treatment or facing fertility problems, they are excellent study participants because they remember everything. They're very, very good reporters.
That is so true.
And they're very aware of even the smallest things they do. So if you have an open-ended question, it's like, did you drink coffee? It's like, sure, I drink coffee. Like 5 weeks ago, I drank a cup of coffee and I've never done it again. But if it becomes a yes, no answer, and you have no choice but to report yes. And then the investigators would go to the labor and delivery room and somebody has just had a baby and was like, did you drink coffee? It's like, I don't know if I've had coffee. I have a baby. So if that is the information that you're collecting, you're all but guaranteed to find an association between coffee drinking and infertility. So as more high quality studies have started to accrue, the association between coffee and fertility has become more questionable. So there's if you look at the more recent higher quality studies, most of them report absolutely no relationship between caffeine intake and either semen quality parameters. They make absolutely no difference. There doesn't seem to be a relationship with time to pregnancy either. There doesn't seem to be a relationship with success in ART setting. We collaborated with a group in Israel recently, where we did a really interesting study because unlike the United States, in Israel, there's not this social bias towards drinking coffee during pregnancy. So people continue to drink coffee throughout infertility treatment. And what we found in this study in Israel is that coffee drinking made absolutely no difference in terms of infertility treatment outcomes, but there was only one caffeinated beverage that made a difference, which was sugared sodas. And so we think that it was the sugar and not the soda, and not the caffeine.
Not the caffeine, yeah.
Right, that made the difference. And recently, a couple of months ago, there was another study published in Fertility and Sterility, looking again at a different population that doesn't share the same biases around caffeine that we have. So these were couples undergoing infertility treatment in Denmark. And what they see is absolutely nothing. So couples undergoing infertility treatment in Denmark, coffee seems to make no difference whatsoever. And when they look separately at couples who are doing IVF versus IUI, the couples doing IUI actually seem to do a little better when they drink coffee than the couples who do not drink coffee. So I think if you not only look at the headcount, right, that you count papers and say, well, what's their conclusion, but you also take into account the quality of the studies and whether or not they've been thoughtful about designing their study, it has become less clear whether or not coffee is deleterious to fertility.
That's
and there is one big exception, though, which is that coffee does seem to be related to miscarriage in couples who get pregnant on their own. So the question is, well, if this is true, it doesn't impact your ability to get pregnant, but it may increase slightly the chance of losing a pregnancy. So how do you balance those two things? And the studies that have identified problems with pregnancy loss, most of them suggest that the deleterious effect of caffeine starts right around the time that the recommended intake that ACOG and other organizations suggest as the maximum level of intake for women who are pregnant or trying to get pregnant, which is around 300 milligrams of coffee, of caffeine per day. So roughly 2 to 3 cups of coffee per day. So the risk appears to happen beyond that intake, but not before that.
Okay, that's interesting. So again, it would go back to fairly moderate coffee consumption.
Correct.
This show would not happen without the generous support of our partners. And these are organizations and clinics who believe in our mission of providing unbiased, medically accurate information to the patient community. I want to tell you about two such partners. One is Cooper Surgical. Cooper Surgical Fertility and Genomic Solutions are global leaders in IVF and reproductive genetics. They offer a whole host of genetic testing, PGTA, PGTM, PGTSR, and they also do some endometrial receptivity testing for individuals and couples. And Cooper Genomics is very proud to provide comprehensive genetic counseling to all of their patients. Another partner is Walgreens and AllianceRx Walgreens Prime. They provide specialized fertility pharmacy services throughout a network of a care team, and they are available 24/7, and they truly are devoted to helping patients achieve successful outcomes. They understand the importance of timing and the need for personalized treatment and are committed to compassionate care and support throughout a patient's journey. Again, the blogosphere is full of information about supplements that women and men should take if they're wanting to get pregnant. And it ratchets up even more when people are in fertility treatment and are truly Googling and trying to find information. So I want to talk about the impact of supplements for people conceiving naturally and the impact of supplements for people undergoing fertility treatment. We've already talked about the importance of prenatal vitamins, so we won't spend much time on that. Let's talk about, I think that that's pretty much universally agreed now that you should be on a prenatal vitamin. Let's talk about some of the other potential supplements. You mentioned the importance of vitamin B12. Now, that is included, generally speaking, in prenatal vitamins. Is this a case where if a little, which is included in your prenatal vitamin, is good, a little bit more might be better? Should women considering pregnancy or undergoing infertility treatment supplement with additional vitamin B12?
The answer is, I don't know. So, like coffee and micronutrient supplements have been investigated a lot. There's tons of randomized trials among infertile couples reporting the effects of this supplement or that supplement. There's been two Cochrane reviews on the effects of...
Two what type of reviews did you say?
From the Cochrane collaboration.
So gotcha.
Reviewing the effects of... They're called antioxidants, although they're not really all antioxidants. They're mainly... micronutrient supplementation in both male fertility and female fertility, and what they mean is among couples who are undergoing fertility treatment. And they come to the conclusion that, yes, there's a lot of trials out there, but they all share a common problem. It means that pretty much every single trial that's out there has been done because somebody is promoting their own supplement, right?
Yeah, so exactly.
They run the trial and they say, okay, if the main purpose of the trial is, well, the supplement A that I'm going to sell at $100 a bottle or whatever, work, yes or no, then you're going to run your study a certain way. You might compare it against placebo as opposed to something which is not something you would necessarily do in real life, right? You would, if for a couple who's trying to get pregnant, you would not give them a placebo. You would at least give them the minimum recommendations for micronutrient supplementation to for a pregnancy, first. Mm-hmm. And second of all, because everybody's interested in their own blend of supplements, it is really not possible to identify what are the effects of any one individual nutrient. So I think that the for both the in both the male review and the female review, what they find is that if you pull the data across all these trials together, you do see a signal. And there does seem that supplementing both men and women with a micronutrient supplement can be beneficial for improving fertility treatment outcomes. The problems are that in either review, there's no two trials that are actually testing the exact same intervention. So there's no two trials that are testing the exact same thing. So you cannot tell, well, what is it exactly in the supplements that's helping, right? And second, because you do not have these exact same two trials, it becomes really, really difficult to define, well, maybe the best supplement is something that has these things or that things. And so you cannot tell what are the things that are working, but you can also not things where you can also not identify what are the components of these supplements that are doing nothing or may be harmful, right? So you're just seeing the average effect across many different supplements, across many different trials, none of which are the same one to the other. So the optimistic view is we know something works. We just don't know what it is, right? And our job is to try to figure out what is it that's helping. So we've talked a little bit about already the one carbon metabolism, so folate, B12, and B6. And I think that the evidence is actually growing in strength, supporting a role for both folate and B12 in particular, in having a very, very important role in females specifically. So you would think, well, if I'm already taking a multivitamin, which already has folate, already has B12.
Right, because most prenatals do.
Then how is this important to me? And what we've been able to find is that even within the range of intake among couples undergoing fertility treatment, we do see that slightly different doses of folic acid and B12 do make a difference in terms of who is more successful versus not. Now, to clarify this question, what we need is another trial testing different doses of folic acid and different doses of B12 to see whether our findings stand up to the ultimate test of whether or not they're true. But they definitely are suggestive. I think it's also important to mention what are things that are unlikely to make more benefit, right? That are unlikely to help you much more in terms of fertility. And one of them is a very popular vitamin, which is vitamin D. So there has now fairly consistent literature looking at the effects of vitamin D on reproduction. So most of the initial literature on animal reproduction, looking at the underlying biology, has shown that vitamin D is actually crucial for reproduction. Mm-hmm. So if you're completely deficient, then you do definitely need, so vitamin D deficiency is not consistent with reproduction. You do need vitamin D for reproduction.
But how do we define deficient? Isn't that kind of, therein lies the rub?
That is one of the things, but you focusing specifically on studies among couples undergoing ART, which is where there's actually a surprising amount of research. What the literature has shown is that when you use either the IOM or the Endocrine Society cutoffs for deficiency, it doesn't matter which one it is, you do see a benefit of vitamin D when you're comparing women who are deficient versus women who are not, right? Meaning if you have really low stores of vitamin D, it probably makes sense to have a vitamin D supplement and get your levels beyond the very low thresholds. But when you look at couples who are within the replete range of serum vitamin D, there doesn't seem to be much more benefit to gain, right? So you may gain in terms of other potential benefits, but probably not in terms of reproduction. So if you get screened and get identified as vitamin D deficient or insufficient, then vitamin D probably makes sense. If you're within the normal range already, getting additional vitamin D above and beyond what you would normally be getting from diet plus sun or any other supplements you may be taking is probably not going to make much more difference in terms of reproduction.
Okay, let's talk about fish oil. You've talked about the importance of fish. for mm-hmm. people who do not eat two or three servings of fish. And let's be honest, it needs to be the high fatty fish to really get the most value out of it. Mm-hmm. And then we run into problems with contaminants and metals and things such as that. So for people who are wanting to increase and get the omega-6 fatty acids of fish, does fish oil supplementation help?
So the best evidence on that we have on that is on the male end. And on the male end, we do know that fish oil supplements do have an equivalent effect of fish itself. And if anything, they might do a little better. Than fish itself. So fish oil supplements work really, really well on men in terms of improving semen quality. On the female end, there's less data at the moment, right? So, for example, some of the randomized trials, including the Cochrane review, were fish oil trials. But there's so few fish oil trials on exclusively that it's hard to tell whether or not the fish oil specifically, as opposed to other things that might be including in supplements that include fish oil as part of the formulation, might be the thing that's doing the trick.
Okay, what about CoQ10?
Again, CoQ10, there's lots of evidence on the male end that it improves semen quality. So if that's the target, that's fine. There are no trials looking at CoQ10 on the male end with live birth or pregnancy as the outcome.
So you mean the female end, didn't you?
Both male and female, right. Oh. So the trials that have been done on males include trials that look at semen quality as the outcomes. Those are the most common, but there's also trials where the man is being supplemented, but not the woman, to look at couple outcomes, right? To say, well, does supplementing the man with fish oil or multivitamin or whatever impacts the couple's ability to become pregnant. So the same,
you're speaking of CoQ10 as well. So yeah. It may improve semen quality, but there hasn't been any indication that it improves pregnancy rates in general?
Exactly. And the question is, well, to what extent does improving semen quality improves your chances of becoming pregnant?
Yeah.
And it turns out it depends. It depends on where do you start, where do you end, right? So let's say because it's very, very different to, let's say that you're improving semen quality by an absolute amount. Say you're improving sperm concentration by, I don't know, 20 million sperm per mil, right? It's very different to start with 5 million and go to 25. That's an enormous change than to start with 150 and end up with 175,000. It's the same change, but the person who's definitely going to benefit the most is the guy who started with 5 million to begin with. And probably the first guy, that's going to make an enormous difference in his chance of fathering a pregnancy. But on the second guy, it probably makes no difference whatsoever.
And for women, is there any indication from the research that you've read, and you've read it all, is there any indication that CoQ10 would be been a supplement that women who are undergoing treatment or trying to conceive naturally?
Yeah. No, so again, it's one of those I would put in the same bag of we don't know, right? So there have been some trials looking at CoQ10 specifically, or in combination with other antioxidants and other macronutrients. So as a whole, when you put everything in the same bag and say, well, does giving somebody a pill with some micronutrient help? It's like, yes. Is it CoQ10? Well, we don't know. Maybe, but we really don't know.
Okay. What about, and this one may be more controversial than the other ones, DHEA. And I can't pronounce the chemical name.
Yeah. Again, I'm going to sit down that one too. Because for that one, I think it would still fall in the same bag of we really don't know. And for the most part, there are many of the trials that have been done looking at these particular supplements, as well as other supplements, have a strong commercial bias. So even summarizing the evidence is difficult. So it leaves us with the unfortunate conclusion of saying, well, we know something helps, we just don't know what it is.
Okay, so what supplements then, we'll let you have the final say then, what supplements would you recommend other than a basic prenatal vitamin?
Actually, I think nothing. I think that most of the benefit probably comes from what you would find on a standard prenatal diet, really. Even the ones for which we find the strongest evidence, which we think couples undergo infertility treatment, which are the nutrients involved in the one carbon metabolism, so folate, B6, B12. The differences are between going from a standard multivitamin to a standard prenatal or to even prescription prenatal, which has a little bit more folic acid and a little bit of B12. So it's nothing that it's not available already. And the differences, and so getting the specific information on what's the right dose is something that probably needs to be figured out, but it's not going to happen in the next, it's not going to happen anytime soon. So in the meantime, if you're up to making a decision for yourself today, I think that if you go with a standard prenatal, you're probably just as good and up to date with the science than if you spend hundreds of dollars for something that may be just the same thing, but sold under a different brand.
Well, thank you so much, Dr. Jorge Chavarro, who is the Associate Professor of Nutrition and Epidemiology at the Harvard School of Public Health and Medicine at Harvard Medical School. We really appreciate your input and your wisdom and your ability to have dissected and read through all of this research. It was great. Let me remind everyone that views expressed in this show are those of the guests and do not necessarily reflect the position of Creating a Family, our partners, or our underwriters. Also, keep in mind that the information given in this interview is general advice. To understand how it applies to your specific situation, you need to work with your infertility professional. Thank you guys for listening, and I will see you next week.